Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites. Man, it has been a while, and it's good to be back. I'm one of the co-hosts, Mike Bentley. I'm joined today by my two new co-hosts,
Ellie Lane
and
Laura Rosenwald.
We nailed it on our first try. Definitely no magical editing here to take out any other attempts at that. So excited to be back with the podcast, and really excited to be able to bring you some new research, some exciting news and pest control information. For those that have heard episodes in the past, you'll know that our typical format here is that we will bring on a special guest, and the special guest serves as the judge to judge our ability to present a new publication or maybe some new pest control science news, something that we try to cover in 5 minutes or less. And then our special guest will judge who does the best job at that and crown one of those individuals the king or queen of the podcast for the month. Well, I think what would be better than having just any old special guest on is both of my two new and amazing colleagues are going to be our special guests for this episode and our return to the podcast series here. So what we're going to do for today's episode is we're going to have both Ellie and Laura not only serve as our special guests, give us some background information on themselves, their research backgrounds and where they come from, but also another slight change to the format here is that we'll usually go through and we will highlight someone else's research. We'll find something cool or interesting that we found over the last month or so and present that to you in that 5 minutes or less. Well, most people may not realize that when we're not entomologists for the pest control industry, we have all been researchers and scientists in our former academic lives. So rather than showcasing other folks' research, I thought it'd be kind of fun for everybody to get to hear some of the cool and awesome science that both Ellie and Laura, and surprisingly enough, even myself, have been involved in our past academic lives. So that's what we're going to do today. That's how we're going to roll this episode. But we will return to our normal podcast format starting next episode. But all right, well, let's get to it. So first, I would like to introduce everybody to Ellie Lane. So Ellie is one of our amazing entomologists on staff. Ellie, let us know what school you went to and how long you've been with MPMA so far.
Yeah, so it's great to be on the podcast. I am relatively new to MPMA. I started here in January of 2023. And prior to that, I graduated about a month before from Virginia Tech. So I got my master's degree in entomology from Virginia Tech. I also got my undergraduate degree in biology from Virginia Tech. So I am very much a Hokie through and through. For my master's degree, I was mainly doing my research at one of the extension centers down in the Virginia Beach area. So not the usual Virginia Tech campus that some of you may be familiar with, but over there, I was working with commercial nurseries over on the eastern side of Virginia.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I will tell you, it's definitely an area that I know very little about in terms of landscape and ornamental entomology for sure. So awesome to have you on board. You certainly helped to round out our academic prowess here. And I know for all of our Virginia Tech fans, certainly happy to have you on board as well.
Yeah, go Hokies.
Yeah, go Hokies. I'll get the Go Gators in there at the end here. All right. So our other special guest for today is my other amazing co-host, Laura Rosenwald. Laura, tell us a little bit about where you went to school, your academic research background, and how long you've been with MPMA.
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. Excited to be here. Excited to add to the listener count of both of our moms, I'm assuming.
That's going to bring the listener count up to, I think, six now, I believe.
Wow.
We'll hit six if every one of our moms listens. That's going to be good.
Yeah. It's going to be so good. Anyway, so I have been at MPMA for a little over a year now. So I'm the Training and Resource Center Manager here at MPMA. I got my undergrad degree at Georgetown University in environmental biology, and I did some work there working on butterflies back in the day. And then after undergrad, I took a bit of a year off and I worked at a brewery for a year, which was super fun. And then I decided I missed science. So then I went back to school and I decided to go to the University of Kentucky, where I got my master's degree in entomology.
That's awesome. Well, I will tell you, we look for a lot of very important and specific criteria in the hiring process. And I can say honestly that seeing that you had worked for a brewery was certainly something that may have stood out. I'm not saying it helped. I'm not saying it didn't help. But as a person that brews their own beer and enjoys beer, all different types of beer, knowing that we were going to have not only a spider expert and an entomologist, but also a beer expert to the team. Definitely helped out with the hiring process. That's for sure. So
listen, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. I'll take my gifts where I can get them.
Awesome. Well, all right. So as promised, what we're going to do today is we're going to go through and each one of us are going to talk a little bit about some of our research. I guess I should also probably share a little bit about my background, because I don't know if I've ever actually done that before either.
It's a new beginning.
I know. We'll just pretend like the last few years haven't happened. I'm also on our technical team. Much like Ellie, all of my degrees are from the same place. So I went to the University of Florida in my undergraduate years. I originally thought I was going to go to law school. Clearly, that was not the career track that I chose. So my undergraduate is in criminology and pre-law, and then my master's and doctorate degrees both came from the entomology department at the University of Florida. Master's was in medical and veterinary entomology, where I looked at malaria transmitting mosquitoes and some ways in which light and other host seeking behaviors for those mosquitoes are affected. And then my doctorate research, which is something that I'm going to highlight a little bit later, all focused on an invasive ant species. So I don't want to spoiler alert and give you away too much. So I'll save that for my recap portion. But so we are your industry's technical team. So part of our role is to help provide technical resources, consultation, and guidance and services in the form of development of resources and training needs, in addition to also providing pest ID, and answering any pest control related questions that you may have. So when you reach out to us, you submit pest IDs. These are the folks that are usually fielding those questions. So we encourage you to reach out to us. We'll be sure to have some more information in the summary of this episode. We'll have some links for how you can submit if you've got pest ID questions, those sorts of things. But all right, well, let's get down to it. So Ellie and Laura, in a full contact rock, paper, scissors competition earlier, I believe Laura was the winner, and they both knew the value of going first versus going second. So Laura won and Ellie is going first. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I am the guinea pig.
All right. Awesome. Well, Ellie, you know the rules here, but for anybody that may be tuning in for the first time, the way that our game works is each one of us has about 5 minutes to cover a summary of whatever research topic, research paper, or a news article or new discovery that we are highlighting for this episode. So Ellie, once you read your title, which sometimes can take up to 5 minutes to read those long titles that us boring scientists like to come up with, we'll start the clock. You'll have 5 minutes or less to cover your research. So go ahead and be sure to include the title of your paper. And then we can also, at the end of all of this, we'll have some more information about how you can find out more about those research articles and maybe even some links to them as well. So, all right. So Ellie, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. All right. So this is a paper that is from my research, and this was, I worked under my advisor, Dr. Alejandro Del Pozo, and we submitted this to the Journal of Environmental Entomology, and it was published in July of 2023. So even though I submitted it before I graduated, it only came out a few months ago because sometimes things can take a while, but I hope it was well worth it. The title of the paper is Temporal and Spatial Factors Influencing Cistena Frontalis, Coleoptera chrysomelidae behavior in Virginia nurseries. All right. So the subject of my study was the red-headed flea beetle. That's what Cistena frontalis is. And it requires a little bit of introduction to anyone who's not in agriculture or ornamental production. So probably most of you have not heard of it, because I certainly hadn't before I started studying it. So This beetle causes damage by eating the leaves of a wide variety of plants. In the context of my study, I was concerned about the damage this beetle can do to ornamental plants. So particularly, I looked at hydrangeas, hollies, and Virginia sweet spires. And this was in commercial nurseries, specifically in Eastern Virginia. Now, the damage it causes is of top concern to the growers as they value and require their crops to be of high quality in order to be sold. No one wants a chewed up, ugly looking plant. So this pest is likely a native species that grew to be a problem within the last decade or so and is cited by Virginia nursery growers as their top pest of concern. The thing is that there's not much known about it, as there are with many other common agricultural pests that have decades of research. So I was really doing a lot of baseline research here. Now, some other context is that in efforts to control these beetles, some of these growers are spraying products as often as 3 times a week when there are high beetle numbers. Now, this brings me to the first major study objective, which was determining when those beetle numbers are high. So different climates affect the beetle's emergence and the number of generations per year. And so when we know when those generations are and when those numbers are high, that could allow growers to use certain products that have limits of uses per year so that they're using them when they will be most effective, saving them money and reducing the amount of products that they need to use. So to look at that, what I did was picture me with a leaf blower set on vacuum mode and a vacuum bag at the end of it, a little mesh bag, and vacuuming little tiny beetles off of plants once a week for from March to October for 2 years. And so I found out how many beetles per plant we were looking at across a bunch of different kinds of plants that were getting eaten up. And so we found that there was most likely 3 generations of these beetles per year. So we were looking at adult peaks look in June, late July, and late August. Now, each beetle life cycle takes about a month. And at the end of the season, their eggs that they have been laying in the soil will overwinter to the next year. And the larvae also live in the plant soil and feed on the roots, but where we don't care as much about the damage they're causing as larvae, because the visual damage from the adults is what matters. Now, another major section of my paper, aside from looking at the whole season, was looking at just one day, just 24 hours, when are they most active? So again, picture me 3 a.m. with a headlamp looking at the beetles and reporting what they're up to. So I went out every 2 hours for a course of 24 hours and found out that they were active during the day. And specifically, they're most active between the hours of 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. Throughout the night, they were definitely there, but they were mostly sedentary. They weren't jumping around or actively eating. Now, the last section of this paper, because I seem to have had so many projects just in one paper, was looking at, okay, so now we know when the beetles are active during the day and during the year. So now we're looking closer at what they're doing. So we looked at what amount of damage could they cause to the plants. So we did an experiment where we put 0, 5, or 25 beetles in a cage with 1 hydrangea plant for a week and then looked at the damage. We ended up finding that 5 individuals was a pretty high number of what's realistic in the field. And that number of individuals could cause 4% damage in a week, which it's more than you think. That's 4% of the plant completely gone. It looks pretty bad. So now we know how much damage they can cause. And so overall, with all of this put together, now we told the growers we've got peaks of adults 3 different times throughout the year. We know during the day when they're the most active, and we know how much damage these beetles are causing. So that way they can apply that information and decide when they need to take action on treatments based off of the number of beetles present and how much damage that they'll cause. So all of that worked together to be my major paper for my master's research.
That's awesome. Man, right on 5 minutes too. That's pretty impressive.
I had the stopwatch on my phone because otherwise I'd have no concept of time.
Yeah, well, a little behind the scenes, we always use, every one of us has to use a clock. Otherwise, we'll probably end up talking forever because we're all pretty good at doing that.
Also, science is cool, y'all.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, it's fun to talk about other people's stuff, but it can be, really exciting to be able to highlight your own stuff. That's awesome. So, Laura, I don't know if you, do you have any questions or anything? I don't want to.
Yeah. So you said you were working on hydrangeas, but do these guys feed on anything else that we need to worry about?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are very much generalist beetles. They can feed on almost any plant. They are also known to feed on several different types of vegetables, such as brassicas, which are things like broccoli. I was just looking at them in context of ornamentals. The other plants that were most commonly fed on were Japanese hollies and Virginia sweet spires, as well as dogwoods. Quite a variety of the shrub genre of plants, but these are mostly a problem at the commercial nurseries and are not necessarily a problem in residential areas. So you're probably not going to end up with an infestation because you picked up a gnarly plant from Home Depot.
I mentioned that, or I noticed that you mentioned something about the damage they do to leaves and that being, yes, you know, aesthetic damage and something that, like you said, you don't want to pick up a gnarly plant, but you mentioned that they also will feed on the roots, but that's less concerning. So they do have, there is some measurable feeding damage to the roots, but it doesn't ultimately hurt the tree or the shrub at all.
So the larvae that live in the soil of the containerized plants, they're feeding on the roots as far as we understand them to be, but we can't quantify the damage that may be happening from feeding on the roots. So you can't tell by looking at a plant if there's individuals in the roots. Now, there's ongoing research that's looking at some hyperspectral imagery and trying to see if we can detect damage beyond what a human eye can see. That's a little bit beyond my scope, that some other people in my lab are looking at that. But visually, which is what the growers are concerned about, you're not seeing larvae damage. So if it's there, we're not quite sure. But presence of the larvae means they're going to emerge as adults. So that's why we care about larvae being present, is because of the adult emergence that will inevitably follow.
Awesome. And I think I remember you saying too, Ellie, that, you know, you ended up spending a lot of time talking to growers, especially, yes, the folks in the field that you worked in, where you did a lot of this, the field research, to help educate them on some control solutions for these little guys, right? And girls.
Yeah, definitely. Some of my favorite parts of my master's research were going and speaking with the growers that I was directly working with. They were gracious enough to let me do my research on their properties. Obviously, I can't name them, but they were great to work with. And at the end of my research, I went and gave a presentation about everything I had learned and told them, look, you let me sit on your property for 2 years. Like, this is what I ended up finding. And they were really interested to see. I had a couple other papers that covered some other things like treatment options. They were extremely interested in those findings, and they were excited to take in this information and apply it to their management practices, especially planning what products to use when for the following year. So that would have been this past season. And I haven't talked to them in a while, but hopefully that was able to save them some money in altering their treatment practices.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, they were gracious enough to not only let you be there for 2 years, but apparently all hours of the night too, right?
Yeah. Well, so I actually did the all hours of the night at the Virginia Tech Research Station because I didn't really want to camp out on their property or get locked in. But I mostly did the scouting throughout the season over there because they had the, they were treating there, but when we were observing data or hour to hour activity, we didn't treat any of the plants at the research station. So we are looking at an unencumbered situation there versus with regular nursery activities, things would change a little bit if we were actually at the site.
Awesome. Laura, you got any other questions?
No, I think that's awesome.
Good job, Ellie. Congratulations on that publication too. Like you mentioned, it's brand new, hot off the presses. So
yeah, certainly. It takes things a while to get published, but it's out there now, and I've got a couple of things that got published far after I graduated. So, yeah.
Nice. All right. Laura, you ready?
I guess so.
As you'll ever be, right?
As I'll ever be.
Lay it on us.
Yeah, so like Mike talked about, I got my master's degree studying spiders. He kind of stole my thunder a little bit. I was trying to do a nice build up and then proceeded to just stomp all over that. But yeah, anyway. Thanks, Mike. We edited that. Anyway, so this is a paper that I published back in 2020, so it's a little bit older, but at least one good thing came out of 2020, and that's this paper for me. But this paper was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, Biological Sciences. So pinkies up, y'all, because it's a very fancy journal. But anyway, so I did this with myself and the postdoc in the lab at the time, Michael Sitvarin, and then also my advisor, Dr. Jen White at the University of Kentucky. And this paper is called Endosymbiotic Rickettsiella Causes Cytoplasmic Incompatibility in a Spider Host. Bacteria are single-celled organisms that are found everywhere, from the deepest ocean thermal vents all the way to outer space. But one of the places that we often don't think about bacteria inhabiting is inside the arthropods that we are tasked with managing as pest management professionals. Many arthropods are infected with what we call endosymbionts, which are bacteria or viruses that live inside the cells of the arthropod. Many arthropod endosymbionts are passed on through the mother arthropod. So whatever your mom happens to be infected with, you'll inherit those infections as her offspring. However, some of these endosymbionts are very clever about the way that they get passed on and can manipulate their host's reproductive systems in order to ensure that they make it to the next generation. There are a few of these party tricks that these endosymbionts can use in order to manipulate their host's reproduction. One of the most well-studied is one called cytoplasmic incompatibility. This is a conditional sterility phenotype, which is essentially a very fancy way of saying that it matters who you mate with. Remember that these endosymbionts are passed on through the mom. So if that female is uninfected, this means that the endosymbiont doesn't make it to the offspring. In many cases of cytoplasmic incompatibility, the endosymbiont dictates its spread by manipulating the sperm in the infected male. When that manipulated sperm reaches the eggs of the uninfected female, there's no bacteria there to fix the sperm so that fertilization can occur. These eggs go unfertilized, and that cross won't produce offspring. However, if the female happens to be infected, then the endosymbiont in the female can right the ship, as it may be, and fix the sperm from the infected male, resulting in infected offspring from that cross. Previous work in the lab that I worked in examined these kinds of endosymbionts in Mermessis fraidiorum, which is a small sheet-weaving spider. We brought in our spiders from alfalfa fields and then examined their microbiomes or their bacterial community. We found that Mermessis fraidiorum could be infected with up to 5 different kinds of endosymbionts, 3 strains or varieties of Wolbachia, a strain of Rickettsia, and a strain of Rickettsiella. Now, this Rickettsiella kind of left our heads scratching a little bit because it infected nearly every single spider that we brought in from the field. So we decided to test whether the strain of Rickettsiella was a reproductive manipulator for these spiders. Specifically, this meant testing whether we could see that cytoplasmic incompatibility occurring in these spiders that were only infected with Rickettsiella. We began by creating some symbiont-free spiders using antibiotics. We took the offspring of those antibiotically treated spiders and created the mating pairs that we needed. Following a lot of music from Marvin Gaye and Barry White, we had the results of our mating pairs. We found that when both parents were infected with Rickettsiella, 99.7% of the eggs hatched. When both parents were uninfected, 83.9% of the eggs hatched. Mating pairs with a mom that was infected with Rickettsiella and an uninfected dad had 91.3% of their eggs hatch. However, the pairs with uninfected females mating with Rickettsiella-infected males, which is the mating pair we would expect to see cytoplasmic incompatibility in, only 13.2% of those eggs hatched. This meant that Rickettsiella was causing cytoplasmic incompatibility in Mermessis fraidiorum. So what does this have to do with pest management? Well, what if we could use these bacteria and their manipulations to our advantage? There are a few companies already using cytoplasmic incompatibility in mosquitoes as a means of localized population control. In this case, they release infected males into the environment that don't bite, and they mate with the uninfected females in the area. This causes a drop in the mosquito population thanks to that cytoplasmic incompatibility, producing eggs that won't hatch. Our study with these spiders suggested that these endosymbionts doing cytoplasmic incompatibility may be much more diverse and widespread in arthropods than we previously realized. So endosymbionts like this could potentially be the next tool in your integrated management toolbox.
Very cool. The bugs inside the bugs, right?
Bugs inside the bugs. That's my bugs butter and jam.
Bugs on bugs on bugs. Or bugs in bugs in bugs.
Yes. Inception doesn't have anything on me.
That's right. Actually, that leads me to a real question that I don't know the answer to. Are there bugs inside of bugs? So, there a level of inception? Is there something inside of the endosymbiont?
Yes. That's what's wild about this too. So there's some research coming out now that suggests that the cytoplasmic incompatibility might be kind of mitigated by this thing called a macrophage, which is kind of similar to a virus. So it like kind of infects the bacteria and then does the manipulations too. So it's like going down another level. It's wild. We kind of don't understand how this is all coming together right now, but it's pretty awesome.
That is really cool. I'm like barely wrapping my head around that. One question might be a little bit silly, but logistically, how are you giving the spiders the antibiotics? Was that in their diet?
Little pills.
So I wish. Oh my God, like those horse pills that you get whenever you have an infection. No, so you can buy antibiotics in powder form pretty easily if you work in science. And so that's what we did, and then basically made a solution out of it. And then we just sprayed the antibiotics with, you know, just mixing powdered antibiotics and water and then just spraying it on the spiders. Because like I said, these guys are sheet weavers, so they live their entire lives on these webs. And so they get their water whenever they have do on their webs or something like that. So it was kind of mimicking like a rainfall, except it had antibiotics in it.
That's awesome. And then you were able to test or confirm one way or the other when they had the antibiotics versus when they didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why we used the offspring of that generation. So then we wouldn't have to worry about the after effects of the antibiotics, because as you well know, sometimes that can really wreck you up. So that's why we use the offspring, because we knew that the antibiotics were cleared out. And because these endosymbionts are passed on through the mom, if the mom didn't have it after being treated with antibiotics, then her offspring wouldn't have it. But of course, we did double checking constantly for whether or not the endosymbionts were still there.
That's very cool. Well, maybe we can work in an image somewhere of every one of our pet our subjects of study, because I'm envisioning that. Yeah, you know, I remember when you first told me this, I'm thinking this spider is something like what I saw in Arachnophobia. But even impressive than the science is how big was the spider that you're working with, Laura?
Oh, the spiderlings were like smaller than a poppy seed. So the babies were smaller than a poppy seed. These spiders are very, very tiny. So they were very hard to find in the dirt as well, considering that they were small and brown and like to live at the base of plants. So they blended in very well.
It's crazy.
Joked that I was going to release a book called Spider Yoga. That was just me in random positions looking for spiders out in the field.
Sounds like a good coffee table book.
Yeah.
Nice retirement plan.
Yeah.
Well, so you mentioned something about this application with mosquitoes. I know that, you know, do you see there being any application for any other urban pests maybe? And kind of how, I mean, because I could see how the application would be different based on the biology of the pest, based on how we can administer that antibiotic, or some way, shape, or form affect that the gut endosymbionts. Is there anything you could think of that would be? I'm asking. I don't know. Like, is there any candidate host out there that you think could be a good?
Yeah, for sure. So there's a couple that are out there that we could definitely take advantage of with this kind of technology. So for example, the nice thing about the mosquitoes is that we're literally taking a strain of Wolbachia, this one called Wolbachia that does cytoplasmic incompatibility from one species, and then literally just putting it, that bacteria, into the other species, and then just releasing the males. So the wild type, so the ones that you just find buzzing in your backyard, they don't naturally have it. So the ones that are just out and about don't have it. So when you release the males, that just is doing that population control for you. But Wolbachia is super common in arthropods. One of the estimates says that it's about 30 to 60% of all arthropods might have some kind of form of Wolbachia. So there's a lot out there. Some of the examples that I can think of off the top of my head are fruit flies, Mediterranean flower moths, which would be a great one because the adults don't feed. So then you could really just nip that in the bud pretty easily before the eggs even hatch out. And then one of the other ones is German cockroaches, but I am also not going to be the person to line up to be like, you know what, let's release more German cockroaches into the German cockroach problem. That is not going to be me in any way, shape, or form. So there are definitely wrinkles that need to be ironed out for this, but I think it's super cool, even though it might be a little bit pie in the sky kind of stuff. But
that's awesome. All right, Ellie, you got any other questions for Laura?
So again, kind of a generalized thing, and you might have even mentioned this, but where is the various bacterias? You know, you said they're like, are they inside, like in the digestive system? Are they like on in the cuticle? Where are they living in the arthropod?
So it kind of depends. There's a lot of different factors that tie into where they're going to be located. So one of the things is that, you know, they're mostly in the cells of the arthropod, so they're not going to be like on top of the cuticle, and they're not necessarily going to be in the gut, although there's a lot of research coming out now that says that the gut microbiome is really important to insects and not just humans either. So there's a lot of information coming out about that. But for the reproductive manipulators, a lot of them are located in the reproductive system. So in the ovaries and the testes and all of that good stuff that made everyone giggle and middle school when we did all of that. So but yeah, most of them are located in the reproductive systems. So
gotcha. Okay. So probiotic yogurt for spiders is
yes.
That
on Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, the bar has the bar has definitely been raised. So
are we allowed to ask what year yours is published, Mike, or no?
I think that's necessary information.
Man. All right, here, fun game. I'm going to tell you what year my publication was published. And this is my second to most recent one. And then both of you tell me what you were doing, or maybe what grade you were in.
Oh, no. So, this feels like bullying.
For me, yeah.
Is this ageism at work?
You hear this, everybody? This is the kind of stuff that I deal with on a regular basis. All right. So here we go. So my publication that I'm going to be reading about was published in April of 2016. So Ellie, 2016, what were you doing? What grade?
I was a junior in high school. I was probably in April. That was probably at junior prom.
I don't
like, oh, wow.
I don't like this game anymore. That's awesome. Laura,
I was still working at the brewery then. So I had just graduated from undergrad, and I was working at the brewery. Yeah. I was actually prepping to move to Kentucky though, I think.
Oh, we're nice.
Getting ready to. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Okay. All right. Well, now that I am completely yeah, that's great. Nothing builds the ego and my confidence like letting me know how old and irrelevant all this research is. That's good. All right. Well, let's get down to it. So I should probably start a timer. I know I'm going to be less than 5 minutes famous last words, but I should start a timer. Okay, here we go. So the title of my paper is the thermal breadth of Nilandaria fulva is narrower than that of Solenopsis invicta at 3 thermal ramping rates, 0.1, 0.12, and 0.06 degrees Celsius. The authors for this publication are myself, another one of my advisors on my dissertation was Dr. Daniel Hahn, and then my my chair of the committee was Dr. Faith Oy. All right, so my doctoral research mostly focused on the invasive ant, the Nylandaria fulva, also known as the tawny crazy ant. The species is native to South America, where it isn't really widely considered to be much of a pest in its native range. But unfortunately, here in the southeastern U.S., where the species has been introduced, in the absence of both predators and a lack of other natural factors to keep populations in check, they've allowed the tawny crazy ant in colonies where they become established to dominate in some areas, reaching literally plague-like numbers where they cover the ground entirely. So it literally looks like blankets of ants moving around. Envision something like what you would see in a horror movie where they unleash these hordes of mutant ants that just completely cover everything. That is exactly what it can look like in areas where tawny crazy ants have become established in the southeastern U.S. And once colonies reach these levels, they become nearly impossible to control with most conventional methods. That pretty incredibly, the dead and dying workers in areas where you have zones that have actually been treated with, let's say, maybe a contact product, those dead and dying workers can either completely wear down the active ingredient in that area, or they'll just simply start piling up in dead bodies in the thousands, enough to completely cover these treated areas, essentially creating sort of a corpse bridge for other foragers that allow them to safely cross these treated areas without ever coming in contact with the treated surface. Now, the overarching goal of my research was to investigate in different ways how the tawny crazy ant was able to gain such an incredible competitive advantage over other native and non-native organisms in areas where it invaded to become such a dominant force. The hope here was that some of this information could be used to help improve our control efforts by gaining some insight into the seasonal ecology of this invasive ant. So a lot of things that I focused on in my research were looking at seasonal behavior, seasonal changes, ultimately how this ant would respond to temperatures. Because interestingly enough, at the time, this wasn't a very well-studied ant species. One surprising behavior among tawny crazy ant workers was their ability to outcompete with and displace a specific invasive ant in the southeastern U.S., the red-imported fire ant. And what made this specific thing so incredible was that the red-imported fire ant is widely considered to be one of the most aggressive and damaging invasive ants in the world. It's generally, on average, a larger ant species. They're incredibly aggressive. It's pretty remarkable up until this point. There really weren't any other ants, invasive or native, that were able to put up any sort of competitive fight up against the red imported fire ant. So to have this new species come in to this area and completely displace the red imported fire ant was something we really hadn't seen before in the ant research world. So one of the objectives of my dissertation was to dive into this competitive interaction between the two to try to better understand how the smaller ant species like the tawny crazy ant was able to find success against its larger competitor. To do that, I looked at how they handled both cold and heat. Now, both species are from South America, which is a pretty temperate area, a warmer area where temperatures are typically warmer than what they would that they may experience in the southeastern area, where both ant species overlap. Being able to handle the cold is a major competitive advantage in the ant world. If you can tolerate colder temperatures than your competitor, then you can, say, start to look for food sooner in the morning while temperatures are still warming up and they may be too cold for your rivals to even move. Similarly, being able to tolerate hotter temperatures than your opponent could allow you to forage for food further into the hot hours of the afternoon while your competitor is forced to retreat to the safety of shade and underground tunnels. Now, hot and cold temperature limits are known in ecology as the critical thermal maxima and the critical thermal minima. And in order to find out this temperature tolerance range could be, in order to find out if temperature tolerance could be what was giving the tawny crazy ant a competitive advantage, I exposed workers of both species to increasing and decreasing temperatures and recorded when each of the workers would essentially become knocked down. So they were no longer able to move. Importantly, I also tested both their minimum maximum thresholds at three different ramping rates. So this was able to give us a more accurate data set that may be more ecologically relevant and closer to what we may see in nature. What I found wasn't exactly surprising. The tawny crazy ant had a narrower thermal tolerance range, meaning that the red imported fire ant was able to withstand colder and hotter temperatures than the tawny crazy ant. This wasn't surprising because the red imported fire ant is larger on average than the tawny crazy ant, most of those workers. So the outcome of the study didn't point to the fact that the tawny crazy ant was better at being a competitor for food at any thermal extreme. Let me restate that. That was not correct. So the outcome of the study didn't point to the fact that tawny crazy ant was a better competitor for food at any thermal extremes. So that eliminated that possibility of why this ant species was so competitive. But it did tell us that it wasn't likely that this was the key to the ant's success. Later studies that were conducted looking at these behaviors as well as the tawny crazy ant's behaviors with other species, but most specifically with red imported fire ant, did find out that tawny crazy ant workers actually had the ability to detoxify a venom that the red imported fire ant can produce, which is likely that combined with its sheer numbers are a major factor in the tawny crazy ant's success. So I went over in my time. Luckily, there are no other judges here to flag me. Usually, so I'll tell you guys, I know, yeah. One of you should have had your phone turned up and had the alarm going off. But I'm sure in post-production, we'll add an alarm to this to let everybody know that I killed it in timing and not in a good way and went over by 5 minutes. So.
Awesome.
So there it is. Tawny crazy ants, they're not as tolerant to cold and heat as red imported fire ants.
Cool. Yeah. Number one, Corpse Bridge is going to be the name of my new metal band.
Yep. We are all going to start a new metal band, Corpse Bridge.
I was going to say, is truly the Halloween spirit coming out.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. This episode is going to come out right on Halloween. That's perfect.
So thinking kind of a little bit more about this and the gleam of climate change and warming temperatures and all of that, can you talk a little bit more about how your study would relate to that and maybe the spread of the tawny crazy ant?
A little bit. So, I mean, the easy answer is that as temperatures warm, we're going to see more and more species that are not as tolerant to colder temperatures. That's going to give them, likely confer them the ability to be able to withstand warmer temperatures, which means that we're going to see range expansion, which is essentially what we're already seeing with a lot of things, which is a guarantee for us that more pests are going to be introduced and ranges are going to expand. There were some other studies that I did that looked at maybe some abilities for this ant species to be able to survive sub-freezing temperatures, which is something that they don't typically experience in their native range. And it's pretty incredible how crafty many ant species are, and other ant species or other insects in general are at being able to survive these colder temperatures. So they do have some tricks up their sleeve, but they are pretty cold sensitive. So that's the reason why they're restricted to the southeastern region right now. Certainly if temperatures continue to warm, then we could expect that range expansion for the species could continue to expand outward further out from the southeastern states that it currently is found.
So one thing that I'm kind of wondering, you know, we're talking about the red imported fire ants as well as the tawny crazy ants, and, you know, they're both certainly a problem. And if one's out competing the other, I mean, what sort of infestation would you rather have? Would you rather have a bunch of red imported fire ants, or would you rather have a bunch of crazy ants?
So that's a great question. And I mean, I will tell you that most folks while the red imported fire ant is a wildly aggressive invasive ant species, we do have control tools in the form of baits that are incredibly effective. And when those are combined with surveillance efforts and some other things, we have had historically success in keeping that species in check in some areas. Now, I know that, you know, globally, the species is found all over the place and it's a nightmare. So I wouldn't necessarily encourage anybody to bring it in. But one of my thoughts as a graduate student was kind of along that line of, well, you know, that's the enemy that we know. We have control tools for that. So if we were able to identify a way in which we could flip the competitive advantage back to the red imported fire ant, lean on the fire ant to provide some level of natural control to at least impact that population enough to where they couldn't reach these plague-like numbers to give us more as a control industry, pest control industry, a competitive advantage in controlling them. And then once, if they help to push out the tawny crazy ant, then we have control tools that we can then use to control the red imported fire ant if needed. I mean, it's a pretty wild thing to suggest to folks that we're going to give a very damaging invasive ant species the advantage over another and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, that was a potential thought early on in putting some of these projects together.
Yeah, very much the thought process of a graduate student, because that's where my brain went. And then it's like, wait, no, we shouldn't do that to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's happened before. I mean, we, you know, it's the enemy you know, right? So,
well, we all never go too far from, well, if a black widow and a tarantula got in a fight, who won? Who would win?
Who would win?
who would win, Laura?
Who would win?
I would argue that they would both just sit in a corner and not do anything with each other. That's normally what I told small children.
So the real answer is they wouldn't fight?
They wouldn't fight.
The winner is they both win because they're peaceful beings that would not.
That much like how alone. Today is going with the podcast, everyone is a winner today.
That's so right.
Which one of us is the tarantula?
That's right. Well, and that's a great lead into the next part, which would typically be where we would have our special guests identify winners. But much like the battle between the Black Widow and the tarantula, everybody's going to stay in their respective corners and walk away victors today, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay, cool. Good. This is the first episode that I've ever done where I didn't walk away feeling like I was completely defeated. Well, actually, I can't say that because I had to read off the date of my publication, and then you guys got to tell me what you were doing as barely legal or either not legally allowed to drink or barely allowed to work in a brewery, right?
Listen, I got there. It got me this job, right? Full circle.
I think that was a year after I learned how to drive.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. I can only take so much. All right. Well, I think that's going to, on that note, I think that's probably a pretty good place to end now that I have no dignity left whatsoever. But thank you guys both. Really, really glad we got a chance to share some of your awesome scientific endeavors and achievements with the world. We're certainly lucky to have you guys on the team. Really appreciate all that you've done so far, and excited for everybody else to get to learn about some of the cool things y'all have done. So with that, I think we're going to go ahead and close out this episode. That is officially a wrap for this episode of MPMA Bug Bites.
If you are interested in hearing more about any of the research we cover on the podcast, be sure to check out our pestology blog, which you can find at npmapestology.com. We'll also have a link in the description of the podcast.
And be sure to like and rate the podcast. Leave feedback if you have any, and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the release of a new episode. Thanks for listening.